Welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if I was like a predator, I would be like Lenny the City Hunter from Predator 2, because I have no understanding of race relations in Los Angeles in the 1990s, but a vague idea based on ethnic stereotypes.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and if I were to be a predator, I would be Dr. Kevin Predator, DDS, which is a little joke from our live watch that we did of the first Predator movie, but that's basically the only Predator I feel intimately familiar with. So, Dr. Kev it is.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to be a predator, I would be a Falconer Predator. Two reasons. One, he has a falcon. Two, he's the only predator in the entire franchise, as far as I know, who gets an honorable death. Like, has an awesome... This is in the Robert Rodriguez Predators movie, and the Falconer is the one that eventually kills... Sorry, spoilers. Hanzo, the samurai Yakuza guy, and it's kind of awesome. Like, he doesn't shoot him. He fights him with swords, which I think is cool.
That is extremely cool. We're going to be talking about some things that may not always be good, but will always be extremely cool this week as we cover the Predator franchise, leading up to a discussion of the newest entry, The Predator, in theaters tomorrow. Because of that, we're going to do a segment that goes over all the Predator franchise, including some spoilerless thoughts on the Predator, then a break, then some storm of spoilers, the Predator thoughts, for those of you that need a little bit more detail before you enter the theater. But in addition, if you're a member of our Patreon at patreon.com/stormofspoilers and are a member at the Maester or Small Council level, you'll get a bonus segment of this podcast this week about Fall Film Festival FOMO, because none of us went to the popular fall film festivals and all of us got to read about excellent movies we cannot see right now. This is probably how like some listeners feel all the time. So if you also feel like that, come drink some Fall Film Festival FOMO tea with us on the bonus segment in the Patreon. Also, if you're a fan of Game of Thrones, that might be why you're listening to this podcast. You should know that Con of Thrones 2019 is on. It has been scheduled for July 12th through 14th in Nashville. Joanna, will we have a season of Game of Thrones by then? A final season?
Yeah.
So this will be a Con of Thrones where there will be no spoilers.
Whoa.
It's the first Con of Thrones we could actually talk to everybody about everything. And the three of us will definitely be there along...
Well, except for production spoilers on the spinoff show.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess that's true. Goddamn perpetual ends, Game of Thrones.
I would also like to congratulate the two of you there was a bunch of pictures they put up from last year's con, and they put up some from some of our panels, and they cropped me out, so I'm not salty about that at all.
I think you were just like too close to the like the way that you were definitely sitting on the other side of Dave in that photo for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I was there. Though, yeah,
I'm making a hand gesture, and because of perspective, it sort of looks like I could fit my entire head in my hand if I wanted to. The point is, no one's happy being photographed, but come see us in person. Con of Thrones 2019, July 12th through 14th, after digesting our final breakdown season of Game of Thrones proper, spinoffs pending. Yeah, we'll be plugging that a lot in the future, but just know, this is the first. Con of Thrones, July 12th through 14th. In Nashville. See you there. Joanna, do we have any reviews this week?
Boy, do we. Guys, thank you so much for sending in your reviews, because we didn't have any, and now we have some. And I will read one of them right now. Are you ready?
Yes.
This is from Marie Gramercy, 5 stars. Great pop culture pod, ! Such a big fan that I'm going to leave you all the instructions. I don't think this counts as a recipe to make brown butter Rice Krispie treats. Ingredients: 8 ounces of butter, 1/2 tablespoon Maldonado flaky salt, and 1 bag, 12 ounces of mini marshmallows. Buy 2 bags just in case. Also, don't get organic or vegan ones. 8 ounces to 12 ounces of Rice Krispie cereal. And then here are the instructions. Google normal Rice Krispie treats. You'll need these instructions at the end. Brown your butter, YouTube can explain, in a large saucepan. Then you take the mallow, add it to 1/3 at a time, to like the butter. Mix slowly on the lowest heat setting until it's fully incorporated. Remove from heat, add 1/3 of the cereal and mix in. Add salt. Add 2/3 of Rice Krispie cereal. Stir. Continue adding cereal until it's fully covered but not sitting in the marshmallow. Handle like normal Rice Krispie treats from here. This show is great. Big fan. Specifically, they have some amazing sound effects leading into their Storm Chaser section. More importantly, it's a great discussion on pop culture. The hosts treat each other as well as their listeners with respect, and it's more than just a fine, fun podcast. So thank you for Marie for the kind words and also the brown butter Rice Krispie treat recipe. Rice Krispie treat.
That was really great, despite the lack of tomato, I think.
Why would you put tomatoes in your Rice Krispie treats?
Actually,
why would
you put tomatoes in anything?
In honor of
Cynthia Nixon, I would like to say that you could put tomato in it.
You're right.
In Rice Krispie treats.
In honor of Cynthia Nixon, there are bigger problems in 2018 than what the fuck you want to put on a bagel or in your Rice Krispie treat. So do what pleases you, listeners, even if that's a tomato. But now I am wondering, like, if people have made a savory Rice Krispie treat. I'm sure they have. I'll be Googling recipes while you do the next part.
Yeah, Neil, do the next part.
Yeah, let's do the next part. So we're moving on, and it's time to go storm chasing.
Pew, 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 pew.
So normally we do one movie, show, book, story, whatever. But I've got two this week, just two quick thoughts. My roommate and occasional guest of this podcast, Theo, hurt his back this week. So he was captive audience on the couch for whatever I wanted to watch, which was great because we finally checked out Wrecked, the show that Dave recommended to us. Dave, I have a question.
Yeah.
So far, our take on it, I think we're about 6-7 episodes into the first season. Our take on it is twofold. One, the TNT app, way too many ads.
Yes, definitely. I could, yes.
It seems to be getting slowly but surely more funny. Like, it's not super funny right off the bat. It just gets funnier as you go along. Is that your experience, or is it just not working for us?
No. That is, my experience was similar. The thing to know, I guess, about Wrecked is the current third season that's in the middle of, or I guess towards the end of, is that each season finds a way to sort of redo its premise. So it milks making fun of Lost entirely in the first season. And I think because of that, the showrunners sort of find out towards the end of the season that what they really want to do is a character comedy, not necessarily a Lost riff for a lot of points. So as soon as they, I think, get out of the Lost season, it's really artful the way that they're able to pivot into character comedies into new settings where they're still Wrecked.
All right. So we'll keep on trucking there. Also, we're watching Rogue One this afternoon, and I just wanted to come back to the fact that that movie is very underrated. and that's my full thought.
Oh.
Still the most underrated Star Wars movie.
Perfectly, if not overly rated, Star Wars.
Definitely the best prequel.
Cleared that bar. Yeah. Cleared it.
Good.
Cleared that low bar.
Anyway, so that's the storms that I'm chasing this week. Joanna, I'm also interested in yours. This is a good one.
Sorry, I was looking at savory Rice Krispie treat recipes. Guys, there's so many Rice Krispie treat recipes.
I bet there's like 30 of them with guacamole or avocado.
Oh, disgusting. My favorite is that someone put Rice Krispie, like, there's one post that's just about like what other things you could put Rice Krispie treats on, and it's like Brussels sprouts.
Weird.
And
It's like a breading.
It's sort of, yeah, like a crunchy breading, you know what I mean? So, like, put it on Brussels sprouts, or put it in the center layer of your cake, you know, or put it as an ice cream topping. I don't know, just a way to add some crunch that I never thought of. I guess
I don't know if,
for that purpose. Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever eaten like a Rice Krispie, like a just plain one without any kind of sugar or marshmallow or that'd be interesting.
You've never had a bowl of Rice Krispies?
Well, those usually have sugar and shit on them, right?
Oh, so you're thinking of like puffed rice?
Yeah, just like just the puffed rice without any flavor.
Like some kashi stuff. All right.
Sure.
This is not my storm chasing topic, for the record. my storm chasing topic is we didn't get a chance to talk about the Captain Marvel images that were released last week, I believe, unless I'm having a failure of memory. So I just thought it would be fun for us to talk about that really quickly. It has nothing to do with Predator, as far as we know, except I guess like, I don't know, the
I'm 100% Skrulls. Here for Ben Mendelsohn trying to make Skrullin happen.
So, I mean, what? I guess I would want to ask you guys, like, what's the number one? You only get to pick one. What's the number one thing from the photos that were went up on Entertainment Weekly that got you most excited for Captain Marvel?
I'm sticking with this. I will go with Neil.
Gemma Chan.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Who I just saw and was further delighted about. In Crazy Rich Asians. So,
yes, she's great in Crazy Rich Asians.
She's got a gun in this movie. She's blue. It's all good.
Greenish blue. Yeah. She's like got that Zoe Saldana something happening. She apparently is also great in Humans, which is a show that none of us have watched.
So. I've watched Humans.
Oh, it's a show
I like
that
Humans
Neil
a lot.
Watched. Great. Neil,
it is a great show.
Great. When you know, we read Crazy Rich Asians for our Star Wars Spoilers book club, and one of our listeners, Annie, who's amazing, was like going off on the Gemma Chan casting for Astrid because she's like, she's perfect. She played this like beautiful like robot person in Humans, and of course that's kind of what Astrid is, except you like but with more warmth. And I think that Gemma Chan was the best cast in Crazy Rich Asians, even though the Astrid storyline was not, I think, the best storyline of the movie. Okay, Dave, what is your number one thing that you're excited about?
So, I guess two things, because I was going to go first.
No, wait, what were the rules? I said one thing.
Well, then I didn't get to go first, and so another thing came along. My first thing was going to be the Skrulls, just because it's amazing to finally see them on screen. Like, the Skrull-Kree War is fucking insane, and to be at a point where, like, a decade ago, we were like, maybe this Iron Man thing will work out. Now they're like, yeah, we're just going to drop you in the middle of the Skrull-Kree War. Deal with it, audiences, is amazing. And two, Nine Inch Nails shirt.
All right. I figured you were going to pick Nine Inch Nails shirt. Mine would be the fact that in most of the photos you see, Brie Larson's Carol Danvers has her fist clenched.
Yeah.
You know, she talked a little bit in the interview, for Entertainment Weekly about like Carol Danvers, like issues with authority and sort of anger issues and stuff like that. And I just think that that is like a really crazy cool thing to see in like our first, we have so many caveats for this. Our first Marvel solo title super female superhero.
Co-directed by a woman.
Because we don't want to disrespect Evangeline Lilly and the Wasp. So,
right,
you know.
Because the Wasp has her own franchise. Ant-Man's also there.
Yeah, it's the Wasp and Ant-Man is how I remember that movie going. Anyway, but the idea of, like, I think for so long, like, powerful women, like that, to make them powerful, they also have to be like hypersexualized, which is what Black Widow was when she first joined the franchise, or like super likable or whatever it is. You know, like Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman is just like a person that you're just like, yes, I want to take you home to meet my parents and maybe marry you, Diana. I love you. You know, like sort
but
of.
But also,
thing.
You and just
like,
kicked the shit out of a bunch of Nazis.
Yeah, but not in a like. I don't know. The question of female rage is a really interesting one. It's something that I weirdly just talked to Eliza Scanlon of Sharp Objects about. She was talking about like,
I don't know. It doesn't seem that weird if you watch Sharp Objects.
I guess drawing a line between Captain Marvel and Sharp Objects is what feels weird to me, but it's immediately where my brain went when I read that interview with Brie Larson, because Eliza Scanlon was talking, you know, at a certain point in the TV show, she has to play, like, you know, a lot of anger, angry emotions. And she was like, I was actively uncomfortable being that angry in the show, like in front of the crew and stuff like that, because there's just all this discomfort around female anger. And I think that that's true. And so like the fact that Marvel's like, we don't give a fuck, even we might be owned by Disney, but guess what? We're going to put an angry woman. Like, she's going to be super likable because it's Brie Larson, but she's going to be like, she's not like sugar and spice and everything nice. You know what I mean? Which is
well, really yeah, exciting. That's actually one of the things I've always found really interesting about Captain Marvel is that she's kind of a dick. like, she butts heads with, like, Tony Stark a lot. Like, think about somebody who would be sort of...
Tony Stark's a dick.
Well, yeah. But they, like, they're the same kind of... They're kind of cut from the same mold of... obviously, they have different... in most stories, different... views on things, I think that's a great point. She's not just like a strong character. She's also going to be, at least if it's the same, Captain Marvel from the comic book, she's going to be, you know, not all sunshine and roses.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's something that, you know, the big umbrella fandom has had maybe some issues dealing with when it comes to like someone like Rey, who was like so sweet and likable sort of in the first movie, and in The Last Jedi had to pull off a broader range of emotions, including a lot of anger. And I don't feel like everyone was super comfortable with that. There, you know, I'm not saying that's the only reason why Last Jedi was controversial, but I think it's a reason why. And so this idea that we're getting these women, you know, Furiosa, of course, is a great example of a super angry woman that we want to root for. And so I don't know. I feel like this whole like loose cannon rebel has an issue with authority is like such a stock character for male heroes, and just not one that I get to see women play. So of all the other things that I'm excited about in terms of like this and what it can do for female representation in film, like this idea of female anger has got me the most excited. So there you go.
I'm for it.
Nice. Oh, I'm up last. I am going to do a novel that I read in the spring, but didn't talk about because this week I mostly dedicated to reading Predator comics and things, and we're already going to talk about that. But I do want to shout out Killers of the Flower Moon. It is a nonfiction mystery that tells the story in the 1920s in Osage County, Oklahoma. A whole bunch of people from the Osage tribe were given up pieces of land that ended up being very oil rich. And so all of a sudden, these upper class Oklahomans were Native Americans. And it's America in the 1920s. It's Oklahoma. There's rampant racism. White people did not like the idea that there were so many rich Indians. So all of a sudden, they started dying under mysterious circumstances that very quickly become murder, and that very quickly get elevated to the point that the newly formed FBI needs to be brought in because it's just that big of a crime. The book actually presents a person that could have been the mastermind behind all the murders, and came out last year, and a whole bunch of people rated it like some of their top nonfiction books of last year, which is why I had a copy lying around that I wanted to finally pick up. And I love true crime, so I did it. It's historical true crime, so it's like great. It's like that basically any true crime book that's about the making of the FBI has been pretty, and that has been written in the past decade, has been interesting. There was that one that they made in the Johnny Depp movie that I can't remember the name of now.
Public Enemy?
Public Enemy, yeah.
Or Public Enemies?
Public Enemies. That book is also about a similar time period.
Public's Enemies?
Maybe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's just going to mess me up.
Not sure as you need an S at the end of that one. Yeah.
But I want to read that book and this book again, sort of closer together, because it's interesting to see the time overlap and then the FBI sort of like trying to deal with all these problems and then also being like corrupt from the beginning. It's an interesting time in American history, and Killers of the Flower Moon is a good book.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. That's the whole, we chase down all the storms. Cue the sound effects.
Pew, 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 pew.
All right. That means it's time to talk about Predator, the franchise, not the movie The Predator, or just the movie Predator, or just the movie Predators, or just the movie Predator 2.
Or just Predators in general.
Right, right.
Actually, we're going to probably talk about all of these things.
Yeah, we're gonna touch on all of those things. But first, we have to get something out of the way. Joanna Vanity Fair had a very nice piece on what happened to Olivia Munn promoting the Predator movie at the Toronto Film Festival. Olivia Munn called out that one of her co-stars in a scene in The Predator was actually a convicted sexual predator and was on legal lists having been convicted lawfully, what have you. There are records of him chatting with an underage girl. And when she called this out, the scene was pulled out of the movie. But things got worse this week at the Toronto Film Festival as this story broke to the general public. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, sure. And I should note that, like, according to Olivia Munn, it wasn't like she reported this and then immediately the scene was pulled. It was a bit more of a struggle than that, but the scene was eventually pulled for sure. She went to the Toronto Film Festival with a lot of her co-stars, including Keegan-Michael Key, Trevante Rhodes was there, Boyd Holbrook was there, Jacob Tremblay was there. And they had to do a bunch of press, as is your wont at a film festival, and a number of her co-stars pulled out of some of the interviews. I think for the Variety, she wound up doing a Variety interview sort of one-on-one. But the only one of her co-stars who showed up for that Variety segment was Jacob Tremblay, a literal child. So, she talked to Krista Smith of Vanity Fair, she and Krista are longtime friends. She talked to Krista about sort of feeling like abandoned, like she's the villain, like feeling put in jail. She also talked about going to the premiere of the film and seeing, you know, turning around, like wasn't sitting with the guys because like they didn't, I don't know, aren't talking to her. And then turning around and seeing them give Shane Black a standing ovation. When like, you know, Shane Black sort of wrote this apology, claimed that he didn't know, gave this part to his friend who was a sexual predator, claims he didn't know the extent of this guy's crimes and was like, I wouldn't have done that if I had known. And I think Olivia Munn's main sticking point, among other sticking points, but a major sticking point is like, she was not informed. She was the only member of the cast who had a scene with this person. She was not informed. She was not given the like information of like, do you want to do a scene with, this guy or not? And she found out after the fact. And so she I think that like really, really upset her as much as anything else. So she saw these guys giving her a standing ovation. She called out, that the guys pulled out of doing interviews with her. I watched a few interviews where the guys were there, like Boyd Holbrook and Keegan-Michael Key were in some interviews with her, and they were, like, just looking, like, very somber and stunned and, like, largely agreed with her whenever, you know, she was asked questions about this, but, like, in a pretty low-key manner, I would say. And so she called them out. One cast member, Sterling K. Brown, was not there. And so he sort of responded on Twitter and was like, hey, I'm sorry you feel abandoned. I'm not there, but, you know, you did the right thing. Which actually, I mean, this is my own personal take, but actually Sterling K. Brown's tweets rubbed me the wrong way. First of all, he started the first one with, and I like Sterling K. Brown generally, like so much, but his first tweet about this was he called her my dear to start with. And that immediately put my hackles up because I was just like, it might be just how he affectionately talks to women, but it just sounded so condescending. And I know, I responded poorly to that. And then the fact that he like wrote all these things, but as far as I could tell from that, did not reach out to her personally. And that's another thing that Olivia Munn was like frustrated about is like Shane Black never reached out to her. Shane Black wrote a public apology, but never reached out to her. Like Fox took the scene out, but never reached out to her. Like nobody is talking to her. And that's the isolation she's feeling. So for Sterling K. Brown to write this thing on Twitter, which is basically like, don't let me in with these people. I wasn't even at TIFF. So like, I'm not one of these guys. It looked like such a face save move to me. To do it publicly instead of reaching out to her privately, that it bothered me more than if he hadn't said anything at all. Boyd Holbrook, was put out a statement today, apologizing and saying, like, he did cancel interviews because he didn't know what to say. And now he's like, now I realize how bad that looked and how it must have made Olivia Munn feel. And I apologize for that. So, like, it's tough because I know that these actors are trying to promote a film that, you know, obviously they want to do well. And obviously, like, you know, they don't want this to be the only story about their film, but this is the only story about their film because, like, that's what happens when people like Shane Black, who once again is someone that I like, have liked historically. That's what happens when someone casts like a sexual predator in a movie. Like, there should be consequences for that. I don't think, you know, like, the person to punish is obviously not Olivia Munn. So I don't know. We thought about when we should mention this in the podcast. I kind of wanted to do it off the top so that no one like heard us talking about this franchise and this film and like was waiting for us to mention this whole thing. But if you guys have any further commentary or disagreements or whatever, I'd be happy to hear them.
I would say we're 98% in alignment. The only thing I would say is you can hire sexual predators if everybody's aware that's what's happening. Like, I see where everybody's misstepping and falling into this second chances trap, which I don't believe like that general argument is applied to everything. But I do think regardless of sexual predator, regardless of just creepy guy, anything requires everybody to be on board with, you know, the creative decisions being made. This is the same thing that sort of makes me uncomfortable sometimes with auteur filmmaking or, you know, directors that hide things from actors because they want like genuine responses. I think there's a really delicate creative line that has to do with the consent of everybody in a creative endeavor. And so, although I agree completely with everything that you said, this is primarily an issue that they're hanging this actress out to dry in every possible way you could hang an actress out to dry, from production now through the PR push. And it's extremely disappointing because at any point along that very long time period, like we'll probably talk about, the Predator has had some post-production issues that nobody corrected it, and now we're at the end of it. And so the entire process has just like this lace of disrespect through it. I don't think it's even about like Shane Black necessarily hiring a friend. It's about him disrespecting the people he's working with. Would be my shade of it.
I think it's both, but I think you're right that the like informing, I'm not saying like no one who has ever been put on a watch list can ever have a job with anyone ever again. That's certainly not what I'm saying. Olivia Munn makes a point that this guy, like, you know, the fact that he was messing with kids, with teenagers, young teenager at least, like, she's like, that's my personal line in terms of like second chances is like, you don't get one if you've messed with kids. And, you know, I don't know. I think Shane Black saying like, I just wanted to help a friend is like, that's a really rough thing for to hear a filmmaker that I have admired say.
Well, yeah. And it's, and this is probably my biggest problem with it, is like, it's one thing to want to help a friend. Like, sure, you may have a history with someone, they may have done something bad and you may think that they are, you know, worthy of a second chance. But you can't, like, what the fuck did you think was going to happen?
Right.
They don't need to be in your blockbuster movie, is what I'm saying. Like, there are other ways that Shane Black, could have helped his friend, even with regard to finding employment, but he didn't need to put his friend in a scene with Olivia Munn in order to do that. And that's, I think, one of the things we've been talking about. Oh, we talked about this last week, I think, where, yeah, second chances are a thing. And I think that people should, be able to get them, but you don't get to skip ahead to the end of the line. And also I think that the most important thing is that, this was extremely disrespectful It's extremely disrespectful to not make an actor aware of something like that. Like, I can imagine this might have gone a different way. Like, they were probably worried about Olivia Munn maybe leaving the project if they had told her. But that's her decision to make. And I think that if you're in that, you know, if they had thought about this before they hired Shane Black's friend, that they would, you know, if you have to choose between having Olivia Munn in your movie and hiring the director's friend, I feel like that's an easy decision to make, and you should have made that decision, or you should have consulted with her and then made the decision. It just reeks of a studio. It reeks of a production that's not under control or is not thinking clearly about what they're doing. And that's never a good thing. Like, people shouldn't feel unsafe at their job. And then they shouldn't also then feel unsafe about speaking up about it. Right. Which I think is what they ultimately did to her at TIFF. So as someone who used to do guest spots on Attack of the Show, I am always pro Olivia Munn. I took her in the breakup with Aaron Rodgers. I am team Olivia all the way, and I'm glad that she brought it up, because you know what? This never should have happened. Like, how did you make a big multi-million dollar movie and think that this was going to go okay?
What's additionally ridiculous about this is, like, having seen the movie, like, you know, this movie is a sausage fest. There's literally like two female characters in it. So the fact that this guy is in a solo encounter with the female lead,
it's super
like,
weird.
There's like so few opportunities for that to happen that it's just like, what, why? Like, above,
there's only one opportunity where it could happen, actually, having seen the movie. And I think it's right at the beginning.
Exactly. So, like, in addition to all other things, it's like, and then you put him like with your female lead, like,
I'm not sure this would have saved the movie, but it makes it so we don't know who the fuck she is when she shows up, because the scene that's supposed to show us like what type of character she is not in the movie. It's just all of a sudden she's in the movie and she's in the plot, and they take like a few minutes to explain. But I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
It's true.
It's sad that this is the conversation about the Predator, but I think this is going to be the conversation about the Predator.
Yeah, the sexual Predator. Like, the what's disappointing is, like, I don't know if this should be a factor. This is the last thing I'll say. I don't know if this should be a factor, but, like, when dudes behave badly, it's one thing. When dudes in Hollywood or anywhere behave badly, it's one thing. When it's, like, dudes you admire, like Trevante Rhodes or Keegan-Michael Key, and I don't know if I even want to say badly. I just, be better, please.
Right.
I admire you. I like your work. I like you as people. Please be better.
You know, and honestly, it sounds like Boyd Holbrook was the most honest about it. And I get it. It's that these are tough things to talk about. If you've never, you know, like, if you're just Boyd Holbrook and you're just a bro who's an actor, it might be tough to talk about, but the easy solution to that would be to talk to Olivia Munn and listen to her, and then go do the interviews with her. So I think that's the thing. You just have to trust that the person who's raising the alarm, this woman who's telling you, I don't feel good about this. You just have to trust that that's an authentic thing. And, I feel like sometimes that's a hard thing to get over, which I don't understand personally. But yeah, we need to listen to people when they're raising concerns like this.
When you're shown up by Jacob Tremblay, of all people, it's
yeah,
like,
what did Jacob have to say about it?
Look at your life.
Jacob's like, yeah, I didn't know either, and that's not great, because I'm
Jacob's like, as a child, anybody who attempts to hit on a 14-year-old, I inherently understand a little bit.
Listen, all I'm saying is that Bill Duke would not have stood for this shit.
Sure would not. And that
he would have so many feels about it.
That was a tidy, tidy transition into talking about the larger Predator franchise.
Neil, I hear that you love the Predator franchise. I hear that you have the actual mask from this first film we're going to talk about in your possession. Because you, like, directed it or something.
Yeah, something like that. Well, okay, so this is kind of a fun story. I have very few actually fun stories. But when I was young, high school-ish age, 18, I think. Yeah, or 17. I think I was about to start my senior year in high school, and I was thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. And so I went to visit my aunt who lived in Hollywood. She actually lived around the corner from the Kodak Theater. Up until not long ago, she paid like $600 a month for rent in that area, which was crazy. Anyway, so I went out to meet her, and she just knew a lot of cool creative people. And I went and I took a tour of the Los Angeles film school. And I was thinking, oh, I'm going to go to film school. This is ultimately how we end up with filmschoolrejects.com. But while we were there, we went and we hung out with, one of her friends, who had worked at the time he was at Patrick Tatopoulos's, creature shop, and they were doing, what movie were they doing? They had just done I Am Legend, and they were working on a, what's the Troopers movie? Space Trooper,
Starship Troopers?
Starship Troopers.
Yeah, one of the sequels.
They were working on one of the sequels. They were building like a robot. And so we were hanging out there. He gave me like weird prop things. Like I have a... This is going to... Nope. I'm going to do it. I'm going to say it.
Say
it's
it.
It's a big toe from a model of Alyssa Milano that they did. It's just like a toe, which... has no personal significance to me other than it's just a funny thing that I have.
I don't know how to feel about that.
It's weird, right? Like, he's like, oh, well, I no, have like we this.
Wait, he just after all we talked about last week.
Yeah, like, fact, this isn't wait, the point to get weird. I don't even know. What?
Wait. I'm putting something together. You have Alyssa Milano, a cast of Alyssa Milano's Big Toe, right?
Yeah.
And last week on the podcast or on the bonus podcast, I forget which, you said that the like number one unexpected thing that you were really into sexually in a movie was Laura Dern's hiking boots.
Oh my God.
Do you have a foot thing?
I don't think so.
Are you a foot guy? I'm gonna ask you to think on it. Think
yeah,
on your,
I guess I'll have to consider it. I'll be honest, not something I've ever thought of before.
Okay.
But you never know. I mean, we evolve.
And if you are, I support you.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
So anyway, so we leave the shop and we're hanging out. And we actually go to her friend who works. He worked at Henson's shop. He worked at Patrick Tatopoulos. He was just like the coolest dude. And so we went, we had some food, and then we went back to my aunt's apartment, and she lived like right around the corner from him. So we went over to his place, and he's like, man, you like movies? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, cool, I got some cool stuff for you. And he goes into his bedroom in his closet, and he just starts pulling out things that he's collected over the years that are cool and that he is willing to just give to me. This 17-year-old, I like to call my people, suburban bumpkins. So just this, I'm just some rube from Ohio. But he pulls out this mask and I'm like, oh man, Predator. That's my little brother's favorite movie. And, that was true. And so he gives me this mask to give to my little brother. And he tells me the story. It is actually the original. It's not the mask from the original movie. It's the mold. What's one of like three molds that they used to create the mask that the Predator wears that he eventually takes off before the silent film version with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes. Yeah, that's what we call the original mask. The basis for the molds. God damn you, Neil. That is so cool.
It's very cool.
Just had it in his closet and he's like waiting for the perfect 17-year-old kid to come along.
Yeah. So
that's like a fucking movie Willy Wonka.
Yeah, his name is Cleve. He's a really cool dude. I don't know where he is now, but I've always appreciated it. I tried to give it to my little brother, and he was a little too young, because I think he was like 11 at that point, so I ended up just keeping it.
He was like a trembly age thing, and he didn't want to figure it out.
Yeah, so I've had it all these years.
That's a Predator joke.
It is. So over the years, I think, like I said, it really was my little brother's like favorite movie when he was like 12, and I also love the first Predator. And as I was telling Dave, and this probably helps pull us into the larger world conversation, I think Predator is the series of films where I learned not to be precious about sequels and reboots and whatever. And it wasn't Predator 2, and it wasn't even Alien versus Predator, but it was the Robert Rodriguez Predators, the one that came out in, I don't know, 2000-something. The, you know, when I finally saw that movie, and I remember this is during, this is since I had been in the industry of covering movies. So they came, they premiered it at South by Southwest, and we did like interviews with Robert and Nimrod Antel, who was the director, and we were like super pumped. This was 2010. And, it was just, it was fine. It wasn't great. And I think at that moment I realized like it doesn't matter how bad any of the sequels are. Cause like I had never even watched the Alien versus Predator. Cause I'm like, I don't even want to acknowledge those exist. I've since watched them. Some, there's fun stuff in there. But it's fine. Cause the original one, as we found out with our Slack, absolutely still exists and is amazing. So no matter how many bad Predator movies they make, I'll always have the original on Blu-ray, the Ultimate Edition. I'm ready.
Yeah.
So I don't want to.
That's my Predator history.
I don't want to continually taunt people who are not in our Patreon and don't do our live watches and that sort of thing. But like,
this shit's fun.
This week, Saturday morning, we watched the original Predator with a bunch of our Patreon subscribers. It was really great. I drank all of a Bloody Mary and it was delicious and wonderful. The most entertaining part of the whole thing, and I had never seen the first Predator movie and I was really glad to watch it. The most entertaining part of the whole experience was how mad Dave was that Neil knew so much about the Predator franchise, because Dave is used to being our like encyclopedic knowledge guy. Dave has also been like watching all of the other Predator movies in order to put this piece together, I think, for, I don't know, Polygon or Thrillist, but
for this podcast too, just
and
in
for
general.
This podcast too, and Neil just like waltzed up, whistling a merry tune, and knew so much. And Dave was so mad, and Dave is largely unflappable, but that's the
yeah. It was
most,
it was pretty
it
great,
was pretty solid.
We
comedy.
May not ever experience this again either. Like I don't know if I have another thing in my pocket that's going to come out. This might be my one.
I was just surprised that you kept it under your hat. And then just like right before we started, you're like, here's my original Predator mask from the first
I'm
Predator.
I'm surprised that I had not shown you that, because you've been to my house.
I'm sure I saw like Predator mask and was like, cool, did replica you? Predator okay. mask. But there's a difference between that and the one they made the yeah. molds off of.
I was going to say, because you slept upstairs in the loft, so you slept like 10 feet away from it.
Oh, I'm sure like I saw it and was like, this is some high quality. Neil has some high quality
Man,
props. I didn't know it was the
original. This mold looks really real.
Yeah.
But yeah,
also, if I had found Alyssa Milano's toe, I would have.
I don't even
I mean,
know
it's
where
fine.
That is.
It's
I gotta
fine.
Clean
this
out the
fine.
Garage.
It's support.
It was yeah. so weird. It was like they did the mold, and the weirdest part was they did the mold for like an autopsy scene.
Yeah, I don't know if
so
I want
like,
to own
it was
molds
like
of
dead,
people's bodies.
Dead Alyssa Milano's toe.
Alyssa Milano may have died in another movie, but you know who dies in most Predator movies? Everyone, except the yeah. hero. Is that not the theme? Dave, what are some other... Okay, here's my favorite question to ask Dave when he's watched all the movies of something. Dave, what makes a Predator movie?
Good question, Joanna. Predator movies are 1980s action slashers, which are sort of born out of this hyper-masculine view of the world that was super popular in science fiction and comic books, especially of the 1980s, that got sort of sapped over into action cinema. So basically, someone was like, what if we did Jason in the Jungle and made it an alien? And it was going to be Jean-Claude Van Damme, but instead they decided to make it this crazy creature. And through, you know, trying to make this
Wait,
nice...
Wait, he was almost the Predator?
Yeah, Jean-Claude Van Damme was going to be the Predator. You didn't know that, Neil? I thought you helped cast him.
Neil, do me a favor for the rest of the podcast to say, oh, I knew that. Yeah, I know, I knew that. Just do me that small favor. Thank you.
But the fun thing is, like, until I saw The Predator, I wasn't exactly sure about certain things about the Predator franchise, but with the exception of The Predator, sort of, if we take that as a reboot more than a sequel, Predator movies are very low on plot. They're not like other monster movies. They're more like slashers in the sense that you're getting a basic outline of a character, but the character setup you're getting, all the character setup you get in Act 1 is going to pay off in that movie. These aren't like things that are going to deal on issues. In Predator 2, as a matter of fact, most of Danny Glover's character's dialogue is saying plot points out loud so we know what's actually happening. Very low on plot. There's an alien hunting people. You're going to see through its POV, and you're going to see it as like a wavy, light, jello monster before it actually shows up. The humans are going to realize they're being hunted, and then they're going to kill at least one predator, because the predators, despite being scary in the first movie and it being like, oh, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he like beat this predator man on man. Man, we are the better predator. As the Predator movies wear on, you realize that they're actually kind of bad at their jobs. Like, not a lot of predators make it off of Earth that we see. We just hear about predators make it off of Earth. A lot of them get carried off on stretchers, and then the humans get rewarded by, like, elder predators being like, you are a good warrior. But that, like, happens enough that, like, the predators don't have a good win rate. So I'm going to say low on plot, slasher-like movie, hyper-masculine, Predator loses. That's a Predator movie.
All right.
Also, yeah. Three dots, three laser dots in a triangular pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And
some concern about the location of a helicopter.
Sure. Usually it involves getting to some kind of choppa.
Right.
And I had another one, but I forgot.
Oh, someone calls the Predator an ugly motherfucker.
Right. And yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, instead of co-eds, it's usually, you know, like slasher films have co-eds. Predator movies have groups of usually dangerous people of ill repute, and only one of them is likable. Or even remotely likable.
Yeah, yeah. Or then, like, the one that seems likable takes a turn, or vice versa. Like, yeah, it's hard to stay consistently likable.
It's weird because you usually, in a Predator movie, the range of emotions is you go from rooting for the Predator most of the time to rooting for the hero at the very end.
Yes, I could go with that. Except maybe, well, I okay. Predator 2, I think, is hilarious. Because
a lot of Predator fans don't recognize Predator 2.
Right. It's basically like a different movie because it takes place in this like weird version of Los Angeles where there's open warfare between the Jamaican gangs and the Colombian gangs, and they're like super racist, and Danny Glover is like this cop that takes on Bill Paxton as a rookie, and they're like kind of competent, but Danny Glover's cop is like super disobedient to everybody. He's like yelling at the feds, and he almost like punches his boss like several times, but for some reason they like keep around. He eventually comes across Gary Busey's like scientist character who like finally tells him what's going on. You're like, oh good, maybe Danny Glover will settle down and know his place. But he like punches out a couple government agents and like forces them to let him hunt the Predator. It's like so stupid. And it's so stupid in a way where it's like this simple plot that they still, like I said before, have to speak out loud to you, that I kind of like the charm of it. Because by the end, when it's Danny Glover and Gary Busey and a maskless predator in like this meat locker, like shooting liquid nitrogen and gigantic handguns at each other, it's just that right balance of ridiculous that I think Predators and the Predator also get to that sort of camp value. But they seem to try to be doing it from a more self-aware place, where Predator 2 seems to think like it's telling a really good story, but at any point, anybody who looked at the script would have been like, this is ridiculous.
I love that Predator 2 is basically, it's like if someone wanted to make the movie inside the movie Last Action Hero, but instead of Arnold, they got Danny Glover.
Yeah.
We talked here and elsewhere about how like hyper masculine these movies are, and they really, really are. And I'm interested to see like sort of the way there's usually like a token female character, right? In a Predator movie, a brunette.
Yep.
In the first two, I think you guys said she comes back to the second one. It's, Elpidia Carrillo, who plays Anna. And then I know Alicia Braga is in the Predators. I don't know what the makeup is in the Alien versus Predator. And then in like this one, it's Olivia Munn with Yvonne Strahovski having like a much smaller role. Which is fine. Like, there's, I'm not saying like, you know, you can't have hyper masculinity. Like, especially watching like the original Predator, you're just sort of like, look at all these biceps. Look how oiled they are. It's hilarious and stuff like that. But what's interesting is like how disinterested, this new movie, and you know, we're going to talk about spoilers and not spoilers. And I think this counts as not spoilers, but how disinterested this movie is in like, updating any of the sexual politics of the original film, because in the original film you have Shane Black as a character just saying like disgusting sexist jokes, and you've got
not even any of the funny ones either.
Right. And then you've got this one guy who, like, you know, asks this woman that they have held hostage, like, you know, if she should be on a leash or where's your leash or whatever. Like, yeah. And so exactly to Neil's point, you're like kind of rooting for these guys to die because you're like, these guys suck.
I feel like that's part of the charm.
Yeah. But, you're going to watch all these assholes die. But in the new one, like, as if to pay homage to his original character, Shane Black has given, Tom Jane's character Tourette's, and like, he just says pussy, like, throughout the whole movie, and you're like, okay, I don't know. I just like, it's
it's like, it's like Quentin Tarantino with the N word. It's like, why do you keep doing this?
Why is this your thing?
And yeah, then like, just be about feet or whatever.
And then it forced me to like think about Shane Black and women, and I didn't really want to because like it's not necessarily great throughout his whole career. But we'll get that to that if we ever do like a full Shane Black episode. But I don't know if you guys had, if this like a like was something that you thought about at all, or like if it's worth discussing at all.
I mean, I think it's definitely there for the main Predator movies. AVP and AVPR, the Alien movies, do have strong female leads that are
the aliens.
No, it's Sanaa Lathan plays Alexa in Alien vs. Predator, and in Alien vs. Predator Requiem, it's Ryko Aylesworth, who plays some other soldier. But the idea that, you know, they're kind of like the final girls, I think they're treated better in the Alien vs. Predator movies, probably because those movies have other things in mind besides being comments on masculinity. And I think that's one of those things that sort of sets the Alien versus Predator movies apart. Like the idea that in all the other Predator movies, it needs to be a warm climate, but in Alien versus Predator, they sort of like don't talk about the Predators having anything to do with warmth. But
Before we get to, or I don't know, maybe you can let me know if this feels like it should be in the spoiler section or not, but like, I'm wondering if like, one review I read, I think it was by Brian Bishop on The Verge, like his review title was something like, Shane Black had the opportunity to like reinvent the Predator franchise for you know, this new generation, or the opportunity to translate what's fun and hyper masculine about the original Predator to 2018 and like really miss the mark. And so I'm just wondering, like, what, if you guys have any thoughts about like what that could be in a way that's fun, to take what is like glistening and bicep-y about the original Predator and do it in 2018, or can you not even do that in 2018?
I think that, well, it's tough because it does sound like Shane Black sort of ended up in this weird middle place. Because I get it, like, it's, those movies are fun. They are seminal movies of my childhood, but also like when we watched it again this past weekend, there's language in that movie that it's like, man, that it feels of its time. So right. I guess the question is like, do you make fun of that? Like, Shane Black could have made a movie that was a little like hyper real Predator movie where he sort of leaned into that, but then you still, I don't know. It's really the difference to me in paying homage to, the franchise that you loved when you were a kid versus trying to help it evolve. So I think what, like J.J. Abrams, for instance, what he and Larry Kasdan did with The Force Awakens, they helped Star Wars evolve for a new generation. Whereas what it sounds like Shane Black is doing is he just wanted to make the movie that he saw in 1987, but the audience is very different. And I think describing it as a missed opportunity is both the most generous way to describe it and probably the most accurate, because really what they will ultimately find out, and this is a criticism that I've leveled against all kinds of different franchises, the DC universe, is that if you get stuck obsessing over the sometimes wrong parts, or if you get just stuck obsessing over the feeling that you had in the 1980s, then the new stuff you make is going to feel out of touch. Like, it's going to feel of a different time. And unless that's what you're really going for, I don't think that's a good choice. Like, you need to modernize some of just the way that your movie thinks, I guess. And, so that's always disappointing. Like, my prediction based just on that description alone is that this movie will probably do okay opening weekend and we'll never talk about it again.
I think it's, like, if I were asked how to make a Predator movie, knowing that hypermasculinity was part of it in this current day and age, I think I would do the opposite of what Shane Black tried to do, which is try to make the Predator kind of like a threat again with the introduction of the enhanced Predator or the upgrade Predator. It's the same sort of thing that I think Robert Rodriguez and director Atal, first name Nimrod, there we go.
It's a very, very funny first name,
yes,
by the way.
But I think they also had that idea where it's like, maybe we could make them scarier by making them like bigger or different, or make like a berserker Predator. I'm kind of fine with the idea that the Predator is something that was presented as scary, but then was instantly proven to be kind of like a joke, like a hypermasculine joke. I would see a movie about that. And this weird thing is like, that's kind of what Predator 2 is for half of it. Because the Predator also doesn't know what the fuck's going on with the gang war, and everyone's just sort of like wandering around, bumbling into killing each other. And I kind of feel like this movie goes in the direction of trying to pivot into world building so that they could make the Predator a threat again, but then also moves it squarely into science fiction away from like the slasher thing. And I think those are both bad instincts. They might be instincts to creating a sequel in the early 90s or the early 2000s, maybe even, but they're not going to work for a modern day sequel. So if you're going to make it about masculinity, like, make it about masculinity. Like the way that Predators decided that it was going to be all about the joke that the Predators were the humans. And it like spends an hour making that joke with those characters. And it's not bad. It's a $40 million movie that has character monster fights with costumes. I really enjoy it for that's what it is. But it has that self-consciousness about it that I think the Predator sort of lacks. So I guess, go ahead.
In my memory, I think the greatest success of Predators is I really love, I don't know about you guys, and maybe this is a spoiler for Predators, sorry. But I love when like actors like Topher Grace are made to be villains, because
oh my god, his character in that movie was the worst.
Yeah, but it's like the perfect worst, right? Because like Topher Grace is like, you know, he's a nice guy. It's Topher. It's Eric Foreman. He's so nice. And then, you know, he's like just a smarmy villain, and not in like an unsuccessful way, like a Spider-Man movie, but like in a really like, yeah, this is how
a
you
Spider-Man make movie. The Jewish Spider-Man?
Yeah, Spider-Man.
Bob J. Spider-Man.
Dr. Kevin Spider-Man, yes. But, like, that's, you know, that's like, a fun rug pull of Predators is, like, what goes on with Topher Grace's character. And that's, I think, a fun way to comment on masculinity, is what they do with Topher Grace there.
Well, yeah, and I didn't see The Predator, which we'll get to, but I think the key to making these characters work, these human characters, is they kind of have to be over the top terrible, at least all but one of them. Because that's when you actually are, you're like rooting for the Predator to kill all these other ones so that Adrian Brody or Arnold Schwarzenegger can finish off the Predator. So, I think that, that's part of it too.
I just need to go back and re-enjoy the sentence. Adrian Brody or Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like,
yeah, I mean, honestly,
two are definitely on.
Dave's description of Predator 2 has reminded me that is probably a more fun movie than it gets credit for being. But like, if I were to just say like, what is the Predator franchise? To me, it's a through line from Predator to Predators. And everything else is sort of this ancillary thing, but Predator 2 might be deserving of more.
Well,
thought so, but that's how I would rank them. I mean, it's the original. It's Predators. It's probably Predator 2. And then the two AVP movies you just throw in wherever. And based on what we've said so far, I don't know if the Predator is getting very high on that list.
Hmm. Joanna, before we head into Predator Storm, is there any general warnings you have for people who are contemplating the Predator?
Well, yeah, if you're deciding whether or not to go see the Predator this weekend, I would say that, like, it's not worth your bucks necessarily to see. I don't think seeing it on the big screen is going to do anything for you. I think lowering your standards and watching it when it pops up on, like, HBO Go or whatever, which is how I watched Predators initially several years ago, because I was like, ooh, I'll watch Walton Goggins and anything. And I was like, ooh, not this. But
Walton Goggins does have the best terrible line in that whole movie.
It's very bad. Yeah. But, you know, so I think the Predator will make some, like, semi-decent home viewing because it is, like, partially a great movie. And so I think you will just enjoy the partially great moviness of it and then be able to just breeze past the very bad turn that it takes towards the end. And so, you know, there's a lot of our favorites in there. As we mentioned, Keegan-Michael Key, Trevante Rhodes, Alfie Allen. I love a Tom Jane flick for sure.
Always pro Tom Jane.
Right. So I'm not saying don't see it, but I don't know that I would say definitely see it in the theaters.
I would say you knew going into this podcast when you press play at 0 seconds if you were going to see The Predator this weekend. Because if your answer was yes, you will have a fun enough time to justify going out. If you were on the fence, the answer is no. You could catch up with this Predator movie when you catch up with any of the other Predator movies. But I think for people like Neil and super fans, there's enough fan service and enough cool movie in this to justify it being the thing you watch in theaters that isn't The Nun this week.
Which definitely don't see. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. If you like that sort of thing, go see The Nun, because I heard it's actually okay. But if you're scared, like me, don't see The Nun, because the trailer was bad enough. It was a lot. All right, and it's time, as we do all the weeks, we do this every week. We're going to read some names of some very fantastic people who are among the small council. These are the folks who got to see Dave's meltdown about Predator very live. And so it was great.
So funny.
Here are these people. So we got Aubrey Ayer. Oh, I should have known that. She told me how to do that. Anyway, Michael Filippini, Tommy Fitzgerald, Eve Fonsley, maybe close. Cameron Fowler, Josh Froscheiser, Oliver's Gaga, which I believe was in Venice this week. Saquon Gatling, Amy Gomez, Aaron Gaworik, Kelly Grady, Abby Greiner, Russell Griffin, Fiona Grimm, and Louise Hallam Collins. And I want you guys to know that I was making a very fancy gesture with my hand every time I read a name.
Let's pretend that I am too, as I read. Tyler Hanan, maybe? Or Hanan. James Heath, Stephanie Hoffman, Melissa Horsfall, Spencer Howard, Taylor Hughes, Corey Hume, Holly Hunt, Iski I, Phil Jake. Jack, Greg Jagger, Jaeger, Joe Janka, Felix Jazz, AJ Cabbage, and Christine Crippen, or Kippens. Gosh, sorry, Christine. All right.
We messed up all of our, like, friends' names this week.
I know.
I want to thank Crystal Kirk, Christina Klein, Andrea Kujaik, David Koplos, Joshua Lane, Huang Li, T. Ledoux, Lili Lim, Gretchen Lindensmith, Kwang Yu Liu, Liu? I'm going to go Liu.
You?
I tried. Vince Louis sounds like he's a jazz man, so I'm guessing it's Vince Louis. Elisa Love, Sherlene Love, Ryan M., and Christopher McGrain, thank you guys for being part of the Small Council. You make this podcast possible. Spoilers ahead for Shane Black's The Predator. How do you want to do this, Joanna?
Batten down the hatches.
Batten down the hatches for these spoilers.
Can we start with the ending?
Yeah. What do you want to talk about the ending?
Okay, so, like, well, I guess, should we knock out the premise? Do you want to premise it?
Oh, because if we start with the premise, I have problems with the premise. So, here we go. Movie starts in space. One predator is being chased by another spaceship. The predator that's being chased opens a wormhole that brings him to Earth. He crashes down in the middle of a jungle military operation, kills all but one Black Ops sniper who manages to get this predator's mask and gauntlet out of the ship. And before the United States military, maybe based Project Stargazer picks him up to do this like military cleanup, he ships it to, for some reason, his autistic son, Rory. And because the child is autistic, he doesn't get along with people at school. And rather than hang out with people
at
school...
Wait, is this Jacob Tremblay's character?
It is. Sure is.
He comes home from school and does puzzle books. A ton of puzzle books. Because he is a genius autistic child. And we're told later on during the movie, probably the next step in evolution. And, according to the Predator, the one true warrior of this movie...
Oh, shit. He's the dinosaur girl.
Lex?
No, the one, the clone from the shittier one.
Oh, yeah. So, Kid accidentally activates some sort of homing device on the Predator thing. Sniper Zoo gets picked up by the military. They're about to basically have him killed with all these other problematic military people.
A ragtag team of misfits.
A ragtag team of military misfits.
Just a bunch of meat. That's all you are in this movie.
So they're about to be executed by the military, but they're like, no, wait, turn the bus around and bring them instead to the secret installation where Olivia Munn is studying the Predator. But oh no, they didn't sedate him enough or something because he wakes up and like slaughters them all. Except Olivia Munn, who happens to be naked at the time, so doesn't pose a threat, and he just sort of, like, walks on. Everyone's like, oh, shit, we have to stop this predator. And the military guy's like, damn, he's going after his gear. We gotta stop him from getting to my son. The kid, meanwhile, wears the mask out to Halloween and ends up accidentally killing a guy who throws an apple at him, just trying to bully a kid with autism, you know, as you do. Gets you blown up, your entire house blown up.
Man. This just got good.
The Olivia Munn eventually also becomes a target of the military who tries to kill her to wipe up their mess of this predator escaping. So she joins up with the Looney Misfits, and they're all trying to save Jacob Tremblay, who's out there somewhere. Meanwhile, while they're being hunted by the Predator, they see a silhouette and they're like, oh shit, that's the Predator, because it has like dreadlocks and everything. And we're like, oh yeah, we're going to do a little silhouette hunting scene where they're like hiding behind corners from this silhouette, except they back up into the Predator and you're like, oh, what the fuck? Is there two Predators? And then this giant ass Predator beats in the face of the other Predator, leaving the rest of the movie to be sort of like this hunt for whatever this bigger Predator wants. Anyway, it turns out he wants the ship. The autistic kid not only knows where it is because he's memorized all the Predator maps from wearing the mask for so long, but he's also deciphered like the key passcode to get into the ship. So the military needs the kid. Military takes the kid, kidnaps the kid, takes him to the ship. They open the ship, which lets the bigger Predator in, and then the bigger Predator is like, this is so much fun. I'm going to give you all a head start before I kill you all. So they all decide to stop fighting each other and run into the woods. So the military's teamed up with the snipers and Olivia Munn and the autism child. Everyone's in the woods running from this giant predator. They eventually kill him. But it turns out he didn't succeed at his task, even though it looked like he did and just like decided for some extra sport. No, they've left something behind, because it turns out this whole movie was an attempt for a friendly offshoot of the Predator race to try to save the humans by sneaking us a super suit called the Predator Killer. It's an Iron Man-like suit that goes over the human body but makes you look like a predator, and presumably our hero is going to wear it in the sequel that isn't going to happen to fight these super predators that are fucking with DNA.
It literally ends with Boyd Holbrook being like, hope that comes in my size. Like, fuck, yeah. They're trying to turn Predator into Iron Man is basically, like, the very sour note that this all ends on. It also ends with a time jump, by the way.
That sucks so hard.
It sucks really hard. The Iron Man suit, the Predator Iron Man suit has metal dreads on it. Like, I just need to have some moments about that. But, I'm going to address some of the good. As much as I enjoyed watching Topher Grace be a bad guy in Predators, Sterling K. Brown, who has been mostly a nice guy in things that we've seen, played the perfect asshole.
Yes,
In this movie. So I will give credit where that is due. We should also mention, I mean, this is the spoiler section. I'm just gonna say this too, like, try to be the Neil to Dave in the scenario. The original, they like did massive reshoots. There was a different ending. I don't know about like what ending they shot, but I do know that what Shane Black wanted, like basically there's a MacGuffin, right? There's a thing that Predator Prometheus has brought to the humans to defend themselves. He's like, I give you this gift to defend yourself against these other predators who are going to come here and take over your planet because you're an endangered species. Global warming's making your planet really attractive to predators. So I, the good predator, have come to bring you
global
something.
Global warming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll get to that.
Have come to bring you something, this MacGuffin. And so we don't see it for the whole movie, but we know that there's a thing. And like, what's true in one version of the script is that MacGuffin was going to be Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
And he was going to like open the pod.
Great.
And Arnold, and instead of this fucking Iron Man suit, Arnold Schwarzenegger comes out and he goes, let's go. And then they like go to space.
Yeah, he was like, come join the already in progress space resistance. And you're like, oh shit, that's where Dutch has been?
Yeah. And
awesome.
Schwarzenegger goes, no, thank you. So then they're like, okay, plan B, Iron Man suit. But like, let's talk about a couple things. First of all, this is definitely like a Prometheus story, right? Because this is like one predator bringing a gift of fire or whatever to protect mankind against other predators. But it's also the plot of Terminator 2, because you've got like one, your villain from your previous installment in your franchise. It's here to protect a small boy. And then you've got a bigger, badder, more advanced version of that villain. And that's the real villain of the story. So Shane Black is trying for a bunch of different things here. And it all falls apart, especially in the end. Shane Black, I think, said that, like, I mean, the company line reason why they did reshoots in the end was that their original ending took place in the day and they're like, it looked like garbage, so we decided to set it at night. I don't know that I fully buy that. What do you think, Dave?
So what I heard is the original Act 3, so Edward James Olmos was in this movie. He played a military officer who was also trying to get to Rogue Predator because the military has actually made contact with this human-friendly group of predators, and they would have shown up to provide some support in our third act fight against the Upgrade, who also would have had friends come in the form of other hybrid predators, like one with multiple legs, or maybe a slightly xenomorph-looking one. But like that sort of idea that there was two packs of predators, one that was fucking around with DNA and one that was like human friendly, also fucking around with DNA, but human friendly, and that was going to sort of provide the showdown and everybody would sort of like die in like this predator versus predator human.
That's just showdown. Way too much fucking information about the predators. Like,
well, oh, see, that's the
we don't need to know
movie.
Anything. That's the thing about the first one is like, we don't know what the Predator was all about, because it's just a scary thing that kills anything that's hostile to it. So why couldn't they just do a Predator? And then there's just a bigger one. We don't even know why. There's just a fucking bigger one.
So, Neil.
I don't know. That's very frustrating.
I'm going to blow your mind. You ready?
Oh, God.
They've always come to take our spines to get the spinal fluid out of it.
For DNA.
To get our DNA. It's never been about trophy hunting. They've been coming for our spines.
What?
Yeah. You know, there's just, like, this is how I feel about every Jurassic Park installment. Is I'm just sort of like, I don't need more. I need less.
Just do the thing that works.
Yeah, don't deepen the world. Shallow the world. Keep it shallow.
I mean,
taut. I want it that way.
Honestly, I'm genuinely worried about Shane Black at this point. Like, it's how high was this dude when they made this movie? Because he made some really weird bad decisions.
Also added in the reshoots, I'm told, are all the references to the other non-first Predator movie. So they added Olivia Munn looking at a tablet with stills of the first Predator and stills from the City Hunter Predator from Predator 2. They added the spear from Alien vs. Predator alongside the City Hunter spear in a display case, and they filled out Gary Busey's son's character, who is played by Gary Busey's son, a little bit before he dies. Apparently, I guess he died even earlier, but then the rest of the reshoots, I'm told, are Act 3 changes to make it the forest showdown, and it's really apparent. So Sterling K. Brown, great fucking villain, goes into he's like, let's team up, let's stop fighting, let's fight the super predator that just gave us this hunting ultimatum. He puts on a self-crafted little predator gun that's been made human size, so he has like a shoulder gun. And then I was taking notes and missed him dying. I had to ask the person next to me after the movie ended, Joanna, did he blow off his own head by accident in like one shot?
Yeah, it's like, you could have been watching and you still would have been like, wait, did Sterling K. Brown just die? Like, you didn't have to be taking notes to feel like you missed it.
Okay.
It's like, it's so brief and really strange, but it feels like a classic, like, reshoot error, because like Sterling K. Brown, like, that character is so good in this movie that like, that should have been a big death.
Right.
Same thing happens, I guess, in the original Predator movie, which we were watching last weekend. Cause like, there was a point when there were like 7 guys left, more than I thought were left. And then all of a sudden there were like no guys left. And I was like, I definitely missed at least 2 of those guys dying.
There's a really weird shot of the Predator sitting there all bloodied. And then they cut to someone, and then they cut back to the Predator shot as it starts to fade out. So it's like this really weird cut. And then it fades to the scene where they're like making a memorial for all the people. That feels like it's all of a sudden, like, hours later, but nobody's moved. And then Olivia Munn adds, like, a thing from this character that was basically sexually harassing her the whole time and gives this look like maybe she loved him. I am really confused even before the Predator killer suit comes out, just because, like, as this movie's going, there's, like, the first... It starts pretty much with action, that and it manages, thanks to some Shane Black writing, to basically get through Act 1 and Act 2 before you notice that you're that far through the movie. And then it's all of a sudden the speed bumps just come too frequently to ever pick up that pace again. I think it starts, for me it started, with the Predator dogs are back. They kill one. The other one gets shot in the head in point-blank range, but it like lobotomizes it and makes it nice and like a dog. And then it wanders in and out of scenes, and Olivia Munn's like, no, don't hurt my dog, and like plays fetch with it with their grenade. Wait, happens.
This is in The Predator?
Yes. The Predator like the dog survives till the end.
In a couple of days from right now.
Yeah, so the sequel to The Predator is going to be
a guy in
a Predator Iron Man suit with a friendly Predator dog hunting predators.
This is the dumbest shit I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, it's all at the end.
Wait to see this movie.
So, but like the group of Looney Bin character guys. I really dig. I like the idea of, you know, like, basically having a tertiary understanding of the military, like, harkening back to the first one, which is, like, a whole bunch of badasses who, like, obviously burned out, and now what the fuck? But then third act falls apart. The only thing that's, I think, he really tries to do this respectful use of autism thing, and it just doesn't work.
Woof. That's what I have to say about that.
Yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
That's the only thing I would excise from the whole movie. Otherwise, it's two-thirds of a enjoyable pivot.
Yeah, like, why
do
you need
pivot.
The kid? You don't need the kid.
You don't need the kid.
Or just put the kid in the middle of the street and have someone save him and be like, we need to protect you now. You know, the kid doesn't need to talk.
Well, or become the ultimate warrior, according to the
There's a time jump, and now he, like, understands. Yeah, you're right. You're right. It is the dinosaur girl. Now he understands the predators better than anyone else. Anyway, I'm trying to figure out, like, what is going on with Shane Black, or, you know, once again, if we decide to do a Shane Black Christmas episode, which we're thinking of doing, like, we can maybe relitigate this then, but I'm like, okay, when I see a Shane Black movie that disappoints me, like, what then is Shane Black good at and what is he bad at? And, like, what went wrong here? And I was like, I was doing some research earlier on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I think is, like, the best version of Shane Black. And, I found out reading up on that, like, Shane Black, gave a script to James L. Brooks to look at, and, like, James L. Brooks really liked the first version, and then, like, Shane Black kept revising and it got, like, further and further away from the good, and James L. Brooks is like, no. Bring it back to this and do this and do this other thing. And so then Shane Black's like, and that's when Shane Black added the Gay Perry character, which, like, just try to imagine Kiss Kiss Bang Bang without the Gay Perry character and then just, like, go from there. So, like, I feel like Shane Black needs either a lore structure to be working with. And that's, I think, why Iron Man 3 is a really successful Shane Black film, or someone to be like, no, this is what you're good at. Dial it back to that. Cause even The Nice Guys, which I quite liked, like, I think goes off the rails and loses focus on the core thing that works so well, which is this, like, Ryan Gosling, Russell Crowe dynamic. So when The Predator works, when you really feel like it's a Shane Black movie, in terms of, like, the R-rated violence meets quippy humor, then you're like, yeah, man, I want to watch that movie from start to finish. And then when you get into all this other lore stuff, it's bullshit and it sucks. So, you know, I just wish that, you know, at some point, someone very smart with story had taken a pass on this and been like, no, buddy, drill back down on this and stick it there, you know? And actually, we don't know how much, like, because to me, it kind of feels like maybe, like, the Predator suit stuff and all that stuff that's at the end, the time jump, which kind of feels like it was directed by a different person entirely. We don't know how much that is, like, Fox being like, hey, actually, can we just make this a superhero franchise now? And I don't know if Shane Black is like, I'd prefer not to. And they were like, cool story. We're going to do it anyway.
Hey,
and
remember when we killed Wolverine? We have to replace him with some stuff.
Now it's an Iron Man. Now Predator is an Iron Man franchise. You know what I mean? And it's like,
what you're saying is really speaking to me on a deep level.
I could see how this movie got started, because if you work backwards from Predator hunted by other Predator to bring Dutch back to humanity, yes, I will watch that movie. I will put up with a lot of plot bullshit if that's where it ends up being. And there was a second in this movie where I was like, woof, but if an alien or Arnold Schwarzenegger gets out of that thing, I'm going to be okay with it. And then, you know, they double down with some of the worst bullshit. So I could see where this came from, but it's like, the reason Iron Man 3 is kind of good is it's sort of deconstructionist compared to the other two Iron Mans. This one, it, like, wants to be super additive, and that's not what the Predator franchise needs. It needs to go back, it needs to be more like what it sounds like the reviews of the new Halloween are, which is like, do the thing to the best of your capability, but don't stray from the thing. Like, keep the bones of the beast. Those were never broken. And I think the idea of Predator, you know, is kind of like a dumb action slasher movie is great. I would watch a ton of those. And when the Predator is good, I think it manages to be that. There's some action stuff with the Predator. Everything with the actual costume Predators in this movie is really good. The kills are really good. They do some stuff with, like, blood dripping on an invisible predator that's like, why hasn't a predator movie tried an image that cool before? There's some really cool things in this movie, and then it just all at the end. So
I have two theories. Can I say my two theories?
Yes.
Based on what you guys have told me about this movie, I think one of two things went wrong. One, I think that Joanna makes a great point about Shane Black needing sort of a different voice. And I think that it's kind of like what happened with Michael Bay, where it's like, do you have an influence around this filmmaker that will restrain and focus them,
right,
or will feed into their worst impulses? So like, Jerry Bruckheimer was always that for Michael Bay. All of his best movies were there. When he got to making Transformers movies and they just let him do whatever he want, it got real bad real quick. So I think that in this situation, you have Shane Black writing a movie with Fred Decker, who co-wrote Monster Squad with him, made RoboCop 3. And he seems like the kind of writer who would feed that wanting to build out like a world and a mythology. Whereas if someone would have restrained them, they could have made what Dave was talking about, a very cool, just straightforward Predator movie. So I think that's possibility number one. Possibility number two is that they let Shane Black make a really good movie and Fred Decker helped him make a really great movie. And then they found like the worst person who's like an executive at Fox, like the kind of person where it's like they won't, they just like, no one talks to this guy. He's just terrible. Like, think about the worst person. And they were like, hey, can you punch up this movie a little bit with some mythology? Because what they did add was sounds real dumb. And so I think those are my two theories of what went wrong here. And I haven't even seen it yet. I can't wait. It's going to be great.
Yep. Well, I'm sorry that The Predators is the movie that had to tell us that global warming was going to kill humanity in two generations. But The Predator is that. all right. Anything else, Joanna, before we get done with Predatoring?
I think that's it. I'm really glad that I saw the original Predator. I feel like it filled in a hole, something that.
Oh, that movie is so great.
Helped me understand the 80s a little bit more. And, and I can't wait to watch more movies with all of y'all.
Nice. All right, Neil, what are we up to next week?
Oh, well, next week we're going on a little adventure into the mind of Cary Joji Fukunaga. And his new Netflix series, Maniac. So this is going to involve, obviously, we're going to talk about Maniac, and then we're going to also branch out and maybe talk about the larger works of Cary Fukunaga, like True Detective and the It movie that he didn't get to make and all that fun stuff.
Jane Eyre, Beast of No Nation, Sin Nombre.
Yeah, all those. Oh, and if I was recommending...
Jane Eyre.
Jane Eyre.
Jane Eyre. Whatever.
Aubrey Eyre. Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
Got it. if I were to recommend one, which is one of his more underseen films, it would be Sin Nombre. It's a very powerful film about two young people in Mexico who are trying to make it into the United States. Some people might find that relevant to things in life, and it's what I really loved about it is it is a very sort of gritty, emotionally heavy movie about why people make that journey, which I think is super important, and I would highly recommend it. It is available to rent and stream all over the place. I don't think it's streaming on any like free platforms or anything.
All right, so Maniac for sure, Fukunaga for bonus. And then We'll all get together and have a little powwow next week. Fantastic. All right. Until then, where can people find more of your work on the internet? Miss Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can hear me talking about this week. I will be talking about American Vandal on the Vanity Fair podcast, Still Watching American Vandal Season 2.
Turd Burglar.
Turd Burglar. And I will see you guys next week.
And Neil Miller. Predator expert, Neil Miller.
Original Predator director. You can get me on Twitter at Rejects. And honestly, you can also get me on Twitter at One Perfect Shot. my best work is going into the tweets at this point. So catch you over there. Also, don't forget to follow the show at Storm of Spoilers. And if you got any thoughts about Predators, Predator, a Predator, the Predator, whatever, stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, this week at Polygon.com. I'll be telling you how this Predator movie connects to the previous Predator movies. Probably not the comics, though. Even though I did have fun reading Predator Concrete Jungle, it's in the Predator Omnibus 1. It's part of Comixology Unlimited. If you are somebody subscribed to that, it is super masculine and involves Dutch's brother taking on a Predator in a city. It's like Predator and Predator 2 combined into one movie in a comic book. I'm going to leave you with that because I think you might actually enjoy that. Baby, until next week, don't fall down.
So don't you dare leave me now. Throw my heart on the ground. Cause tonight ain't the night for sorrow. But you can hurt me tomorrow. Okay. It's on you. I used to be a strange fruit, Billie Holiday. Then you